we are now identified as those who are about to die, we who can die tomorrow. And therefore, I think this is where then modern scholarship must come in to begin to show this as our only alternative and to show that it was never the evil of the whites or the evil of this, but that there is evil in positing yourself, one group, as the chosen, that that by itself must have very dangerous and negative consequences.
Afro-American culture and social order, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Welcome to Soundings. My guest this week is Sylvia Winter, a scholar at the National Humanities Center. Professor Winter is head of the African and Afro-American Studies program at Stanford University, where she teaches Spanish, Portuguese, and comparative literature. Professor Winter is a native of Cuba, and she was educated at King's College, London University. Professor Winter's research at the National Humanities Center focuses on the writing of a book entitled Uncle Tom Revisited, a study of blacks as stereotypical characters in Western literature. Professor Winter, you run an Afro-American Studies program at Stanford University. Does that kind of a program spring from the premise that there is racism in American society?
The year that I've had here has been very important for me in being able to clarify in my own mind what it is that can be known from an Afro-American perspective that cannot be known from the other perspectives that are at present established in the university. And it enabled me to try and put in perspective what had really happened in the 60s. And I am arguing that Afro-American studies is part of an intellectual reformation, which included women's studies, Chicana studies, but also included interdisciplinary studies, which surged to the fore. I see this reformation as being of importance for the as important for our knowledge of the human social order as the Reformation after the Civil War, the Puritan Reformation, was for the establishment of the natural sciences. I am arguing that what we are really about and what we are really involved in is an intellectual revolution of, frankly, a very unprecedented magnitude. It really is a way of knowing the world that is different from the way in which we have known the world. No, it does not displace the other forms of knowledge. It is complementary and it exists. That is to say, Afro-American studies only exists because it engages in a dialogue with knowledge about the black as it at present exists. Yes.
Well, let me ask you to generalize a very broad question here. What is it that whites don't know about blacks?
Okay, because you see what Einstein showed, what Copernicus and Galileo showed was that the Earth was not the center of the universe. But for the moment, after that, it was assumed that the Sun was the center. Now, what Einstein showed, if you look from the Earth as a center, you have one body of knowledge. If you look from the Sun as a center, you have another body of knowledge.
So your comparison here is if you look from a white perspective, you have one body of
Precisely.
Knowledge.
Not only that, but as you look from the white perspective and you have that body of knowledge, what you are in effect doing, you are constituting a white perspective which did not exist before the 17th century. Up until the 17th century, whites did not exist. They were Christians. Or they were Mohammedans.
Regardless of color.
Regardless of color. The question of color was not an important distinction. What I am showing, how did these distinctions come to be central and to displace being a Christian or being a Jew? Let us put it this way. Suppose we decided...
Bossing people around?
Not necessarily. It's more important than that. And that is what I want to show. You see, I want us to get away from a moral reading of what we called racism to a cognitive reading to know why it functions as a social competence and why it was logical and necessary.
Well, why was that? Okay. Why was it necessary?
Precisely because... In the constitution of the new social orders that were going to be brought into place after the 17th century, in which, for the first time, before the 17th century, you had multiple centers of power. I mean, political power, social power, religious power. That is to say, you had an Islamic world that was extremely powerful. You had a Christian world, you had, say, the world of China going about in its own orbit, you had the world of Africa, Black Africa, sealed off from the rest of the world, going in its own orbit. You had all of these different worlds going in their own orbit. Now, to understand the expansion of the West, we must remember that Islam, crusading missionary Islam had slammed out all over the world, slashed into Europe, gone down into Africa and created this extraordinary, powerful religious empire based on monotheism. Now, to understand what was going to happen to the West, Islam went into Spain and from in the 7th century and for literally until 1492, the Spaniards were fighting a war of reconquest. Now, as they fought a war of reconquest against Islam, they began to reconstitute Christianity as an aggressive crusading religion as in their counter to Islam. So the jihad of Islam and the crusades of the Christian met each other. Now with that expansion of the crusades for the first time, the West is going to move out of its own borders, and it did not stop. It went all entirely over the world, and it began to constitute for the first time in human history a single world order.
Now how does all of this bear on the relationship between blacks and whites?
Okay, because now for then all of these multiple different orders are going to come together now in a relation. Okay, the West now becomes dominant. The United States is settled. Multiple different groups of people come into America. When their skins were white, they were logically free. You constituted an entity that I call liber. All liberal policies are going to come from the concept of liber, the norm as a free man.
And that means white.
That means white. White and liber. And in fact, if you look at Jefferson, Jefferson pointed out that to be a free man, you either had to be white or you would have had to have bred your blood up to a point where you were 15-16 white. So what I am examining is to show the technology, what I call the social technology or the social rhetorical system by which white and free comes to be perceived at affective and cognitive levels as being linked. Mm-hmm. So in defending whiteness, you are defending freedom. Whiteness then comes to function at two levels, as an empirical fact and as a metaphysical fact. Now, to understand the terrors of racism, you must understand that anybody who is socialized to sense these things metaphysically and empirically will, in defending whiteness, be defending everything that they see as good and as beautiful in the American reality.
Now, when you say empirically and metaphysically,
yes,
you're talking about the interior world and the exterior world, the world of things and tangibles,
yes,
and the world of that exists inside people's
precisely
minds.
Precisely. Right? That is to say, we see whiteness as a fact. That is, as the skin is white. But we do, for example, we do not see blue eyes as a metaphysical fact.
But it's also a psychological fact.
It's a psychological fact. But I think when I mean a metaphysical, we give a... Whiteness comes to be linked through the metaphor of freedom with a moral value. Mm-hmm. Can you understand what I mean? And the proof of this is that Frantz Fanon was able to show that a man who is black could also see whiteness as a metaphysical and moral value, which makes us understand it is nothing instinctive or inherent or biological. It is cultural. Because if a black can value whiteness, can you see what I mean?
Then it ought to work the other way.
What I'm saying it's a cultural coding. It's nothing mm-hmm. that the white is born with.
Well, why does it not work the other
because
way?
Because the entire social and cultural structure has been set up to make us see this interlinking between whiteness and freedom. Now, there have been other counter...
And blackness and what?
And blackness is evil.
Slavery
blackness and... Blackness is slavery. Now, if we see whiteness as freedom and blackness as slavery, and then we widen this out into the whole Christian, the metaphor and symbolism of Christianity itself, where blackness is evil mm-hmm. and whiteness is innocent and good, what I'm trying to show is the power and force of this rhetorical system to condition our most instinctive responses at the very deepest levels.
Your work, Professor Winter, at the National Humanities Center deals with culture and literature, philosophy and history. What kinds of literature are you looking at?
Well, what I tried to do was to look at the earliest projection in the Western system of the relationship between white and black. This took me back to the very beginnings of Christendom and of Christianity, because we often forget that you cannot conceive of Western culture except you see that it is Christendom. Even when it is ostensibly secular, I have found that in tracing back many of the concepts, for example, even the concept of freedom, the whole thrust of freedom by the levelers in the Puritan Revolution, they are intimately related to religious concepts of freedom, to Christian concepts of freedom. So what you had to do, what I have done is to go back and look at the very beginnings of Christianity, when it began to see itself as a crusading, as a missionary religion. Now from that very beginning, little as it knew of Africa, it always saw Africa as the furthest frontier of the human. So for example, in the Bible, when the Ethiopian eunuch is converted. Can you see? The conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch is a testimony to the universality of Christianity. Can you see that? So that the black then comes in as what I now call him the convertible Negro. Can you see what I mean? He's a proof of the Gentiles, the last bastion of the Gentiles, whom Christ's grace and power is so strong that it can convert. And we have to see that Uncle Tom is functioning within this construct of the convertible Negro.
You've just touched, when you say Uncle Tom, on one of the central points of your work here at the National Humanities Center. How does this image of Uncle Tom persist in our society, in our literature today?
I would say that the power and force of Uncle Tom, and it did play a powerful role in the transformation of sentiment that enabled the Civil War, it had very positive and valuable consequences, but it had negative consequences, because in a very funny way, it wasn't really about the black at all. Paradoxically,
in other words, you're not talking solely about the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin.
No. But it's very central, because what I want to try and show, I want to show why did it have the power? Why was it so powerfully effective as it was? And I want to argue that because it was able to hook into the seedbed of a long-established rhetorical system, the whole idea of the natural Christian, the whole idea of the power of Christ's grace, Christ who had come to negate the Jewish law, and to make the Gentiles, who had been the outsiders and not the chosen people, become the chosen people. Now, Uncle Tom then is a testament to the power of Christianity. At the same time, what Mrs. Stowe did was to argue, and this is what John Brown died for, they were saying being a Christian is a more powerful identity than being white.
Or
being black. That was his power. What she tried was to try and get the universe. You see, Christianity has always been both powerfully universal, but there has been a tendency in it for the universal to be incarnated in one group of people, the whites.
Professor Winter, what do you mean by cultural symbols, cultural logic? That's a pretty vague term. Those are vague terms.
Well, I know that's what I've been grappling with. But I suppose perhaps the most fundamental thing I think I've stumbled on this year is that I think you know that there have been extraordinary advances in biological knowledge, and that the greatest discovery has been the discovery about how the gene work, that the gene that is literally the building block of what makes us humans and all living animals is really a coded set of instructions.
And you're saying that this same kind of thing happens
in culture.
I am
arguing that what culture does, cultures are coded sets of instructions for us how to behave as a group, how to identify, how to recognize each other.
Oh, that's pretty grim, isn't it? To look at around in our society and say, well, it's hopeless, it's kind of deterministic.
No, because you see, we make these.
Ah.
we create these and we can uncreate them. That is where human freedom is. But where the sociobiologists are right is that I think Marx once said man makes his own history, but he always makes them in conditions that are given to him. Where the sociobiologists are right is that there are certain biological tendencies which we inherit. But the where the freedom comes in is that we then, man is coded, as Lawrence says, by nature to make his symbols rather than being coded by chemicals and odor to response. We are coded to make our symbols, and we can make them and unmake them. And this is where you come to politics, you see, because depending on the kind of social order you have, that is the kind of symbols you have.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Sylvia Winter is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Professor Winter is head of the program in African and Afro-American Studies at Stanford University. She teaches Spanish, Portuguese, and comparative literature. At the National Humanities Center, Professor Winter's research deals with what she terms the cultural genealogy of blacks as represented in Western literature from the 16th century into the 20th. Well, if I were to press you, Professor
Yes.
Winter, what if you were to name two or three of these cultural genes, so
Yes.
to speak,
Yes.
what would you call them? How would you describe them?
I think I can use Michel Foucault, who's in his history of sexuality, points out that in aristocratic Europe, we believed in the symbolics of blood. That is to say, man had landed property. He was by birth a noble. Now, the great Puritan Revolution, the Reformation, and the rise of the middle classes would be to what happened? You displaced the symbols of blood. You were not who you were because of whose son you were. But each man was supposed to have been born free by nature. You came into the symbolics of nature. All men are created equal and so on. So then blood, the symbol of blood, is replaced by the symbolics of what I call the nature and the natural.
Well, if democracy has replaced the symbols of blood, why do we have all of this oppression?
Because essentially what we had was middle-class democracy, and where I think we are moving is towards a popular democracy. That is to say, just as middle-class democracy was superior to the aristocracy because it opened and incorporated within its purview a much greater number of people all over the world. It said that man was the son of his works, hijo de sus obras, you know, as you say in the Spanish and so on. Now, popular democracy seems to me that we are working towards is going to be a further realization of middle-class democracy. You take away the middle class, and you're able to incorporate all.
Well, what is new, then, in your argument?
I see a strange beginning. Instead of a homogenized group of people, I see a group of people who, just as you as an individual and I as an individual, we are having this conversation because you are speaking from your perspective and I'm speaking from mine, but we are both recognizing each other's and we are learning from each other's perspectives. Equally, I see that this is what is going to happen. You have to see the group, each group as an individual with the rights to its own individuality. And in recognizing and saying, I would like my individuality, then this is the ground of my respect for yours.
So this is the paradox of individualism and democracy.
It is very much a paradox. It is really saying that once you have posited the right of the individual, then you cannot negate the right of any other individual. Once you've posited the right of one group, then the right of that group is itself based on the recognition of the right of the other.
Professor Winter, in your studies of black and white imagery and the Uncle Tom stereotype in Western literature, you use the term structuring the eye of the beholder, which is to say that we see things because we're conditioned to see things in a certain way. Is that right?
I would say that, but I'd I discard the word conditioned, because I think that this tends to make us feel that we are just programmed, and I think it's much more important than that. You see, I think the difference between us and the animals is this, that our identity is always symbolic. It is never biological. Even when we say, when the sociobiologists say it is natural, that is a symbolic concept of the natural, and we all are impelled to live up to our identity.
So in terms of culture and politics, you're saying that, that we're conditioned in a way to see the world in a certain that sense, but we're free also to change that view.
Precisely. And what you must see, that is to say that to see how the bourgeoisie or the middle classes were able to change the cultural order of the aristocracy is one of the most exciting things that I've been studying this year. Now, the moment you see that, you realize what the 60s were about. The 60s were really about a transformation of the inner eyes with which we see reality. And this is the most far-reaching revolution. So that, you see what I mean? It's not a question. In a sense, we almost deprogram ourselves. When we become religiously converted, when someone has a true religious experience, he'll tell you, I see the world with new eyes. Paul struck down on the road to Damascus, suddenly could no longer persecute Christians. Now, I believe that in our day, knowledge or the cognitive thing is very much like the religious experience. Knowing about the world, suddenly seeing how it works. For one thing, you can never be angry. I know I will never be angry about racism again.
Because, why is that?
Because I see that if I were white, I would have those attitudes too. So I see my position now as being able, just like the middle class man in the aristocratic world, was able to deconstruct and to critique that world because he had no emotional investment in it. So then it seems to me that what Afro-American studies or women's studies or all of these multiple studies, they are positions from which we can say, hey, but also we can say, look, that was good in that. We want to keep that. But that was destructive in that. We want to try and do away with that.
Professor Winter, it surprises me to hear you say that you'll never really get angry again about the social order, about racism that may or may not exist. Why is that? How do you intend to change things? What plan do you have?
Racism is a necessary social competence by which the social order defends itself in the way in which it is instituted. Now, once you see that and you say, well, were I white-skinned in this society, I would have been inculcated with that social competence. In other words, I would have been what you call a racist. At the same time, there are obviously other tendencies in the society, like the universal aspect of Christianity, for example, that has been militating against these. So I would see my role as a scholar in, especially since the atom has been split and we cannot afford any kind of destructive tendencies like racism, any exclusion of another that could lead to the kind of Holocaust. It therefore means that I see my scholarship as providing the information and the point of view, the perspective, which can strengthen those tendencies towards what I'd like to call the Good Samaritan aspect of Christianity.
Professor Winter, you are looking in your work at literature primarily.
Precisely.
The
yes.
The image,
yes.
The problem,
yes.
The stereotype of Uncle Tom,
yeah.
And its racial implications.
Yeah.
It strikes me as kind of funny that writers are generally known, writers and poets are generally known as a pretty liberal lot, which is to say progressive. They are you wouldn't necessarily expect to find racist tendencies in what are called the classics in the literature that seems to find its way into other generations. And yet you're describing, as I understand it, the literature of the West as precisely the element which propagates racism. How do you account for that disparity?
That's a very, very good question, a very central question. And again, I think that Michel Foucault of France, who I think has, you know, his scholarship is the most exciting and illuminating, I think the answer is this, that rather than seeing it as racism, I would be prepared to ban the term entirely. What we should see instead is that the West, as it expanded and affirmed itself upon the world, had to represent both itself and the rest of the world in a certain way. For example, let us look at the Jews. Once the Jews saw themselves as the chosen people of God, they had to see all the rest of mankind as the unchosen. Equally, the West then took away from the Jews through Christianity, displaced the Jews as the chosen people of God, and themselves became the chosen people. And naturally, you logically have to see the other person as unchosen. Now, I'd like to feel that the role of blacks is to become a new form of people, a witness people, a people who say, hey, we no longer can afford the chosen people identity. We have to see ourselves as one, as because once we define anyone, any group, not just whites, who defines itself as a chosen people is then capable of the most extraordinarily unparalleled brutality to anyone whom it sees as unchosen. We saw this with the Aryan. We must remember in Germany, it was not the Germans. It was the Aryans who burnt the Jews to death, because it was the Aryans who chose themselves. And I'll be very honest, Begin sees himself as a new chosen people, and he has no place for the Palestinian. Blacks will behave in the same way. Can you see the point that nobody has a monopoly on evil?
How do you persuade groups of people, cultural groups, how do you persuade them not to see themselves as running the show?
Before the splitting of the atom, we did not have a chance, because all that would happen, one group of chosen would give place to the other group of chosen, who would behave in exactly the same way.
And now that the atom is accessible,
this is the point.
We can't afford it?
We can't afford it. So either we are going to blow ourselves to bits, or we are going to have to come the way of thinking that such a lot of us are people like Foucault, like the philosopher Ricoeur, and so on, that all of us are now in the same boat, and for the first time, we are now identified as those who are about to die, we who can die tomorrow. And therefore, I think this is where then modern scholarship must come in to begin to show this as our only alternative, and to show that it was never the evil of the whites or the evil of this, but that there is evil in positing yourself, one group, as the chosen, that by itself must have very dangerous and negative consequences in the kind of world in which we live. Perhaps earlier, it may have had powerfully creative consequences. And again, always we must hold on to the duality of meaning of a thing, that it could have had powerful and good consequences at a certain time. But once the atom has been split, its tendency is now destructive.
Where is it, Professor Winter, that we can look for some hope in writers in the West, philosophers and historians?
I think that perhaps this could link with your earlier question when you asked how it is that one could say that literature could have had racist tendencies. And then I tried to show that it was not racist, it was a group affirming itself. And I said it was the West affirming itself. And then it was the middle classes affirming themselves. Now, what Black Afro-American studies do, it is beginning to posit not only to see the black, but it is seeing the white from a black perspective. So instead of a monologue of one group on the other, you're going to have a dialogue with each group now negotiating their perspectives with each other. And then this makes us gradually able to see each other in our concrete individuality with our warts and all, not necessarily good and noble and holy. Can you see what I mean? But essentially what we are, and it is this recognition, because it is only when you see another man as abstract, as the Aryans were able to see the Jew, that you're able to burn him in Auschwitz. The moment you abstract a human being, you are able to do anything. When you see him in flesh and blood facing you, even if you have to kill him, that relation, in a sense, cannot be the pushing of a button. You, in a sense, you see that person, you take upon yourself the consequences of your action in a direct relation to him.
Well, there are those, Professor Winter, who would argue that regardless of how one beholds another person, as an abstraction or as flesh and blood, it's still easy to pull the trigger.
If he doesn't have a gun also. That's where we come back to the splitting of the atom. When death is equal, then I think we begin. In fact, that is where the middle classes came in their own. When the nobility had the sword, the aristocracy, but once the gun came into being and the middle class man could get hold of a gun, the aristocracy was doomed to disappear.
Professor Sylvia Winter, it's a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center. Thank you for appearing on Soundings.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on it.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to listen this week for Soundings. The topic will be Afro-American culture and social order, a conversation with Professor Sylvia Winter, head of Afro-American Studies at Stanford University. I hope you'll be listening for Soundings.